Our speakers will be as follows tonight. We'll first hear from Cleon Skousen. I'm sorry. Sorry. I am sorry. I'm a little bit nervous, and that makes it even better, huh? Joel Skousen, and Joel is the editor of World Affairs Brief, and he's also the former director of the Conservative National Committee. We're grateful to have him here, and I will turn the time over to him first of all. I should say that second of all, we'll be hearing from Stephen Jones, and then we'll hear from Jack Monette. Thank you.
It looks like our moderator pulled off the great resurrection, bringing back Cleon Skousen from the dead. Cleon is my uncle, and he's still alive. I'm sure he's very pleased today to look down and see we're celebrating a great victory. For the first time in many, many years, people have, through a great expression of outrage, caused the powers that be in Washington to actually stop a major steamroller, the immigration bill. But they'll be back. This is one of those agendas where they will not take no for an answer. They will never take no. But it's also one of those things that shows you what I'm going to demonstrate tonight in presenting you my general theory about where this is heading. When there is public resistance, and there will eventually be great public resistance against the loss of national sovereignty in this country and the turning of this nation into a global surrogate of the United Nations, they will give you war to turn that around. So just remember, they have ultimate weapons that they have not used yet. And when they don't have complete control, but they have mere effective control, they will use war, they will use crisis, they will use whatever it takes to drive the people into what they want as a new world order. So you see, the issue before us today and in this country is not so much the specific issues that we fight. It's not so much immigration. It's not so much the specific loss of civil rights in the Constitution. It is the fact that we're dealing with a conspiracy in this government. It's that we're dealing with a lying government. We're dealing with a government who you can't trust no matter what you say, no matter what you get them to commit to verbally. This is not a battle that is going to be won in Congress. This is a battle that's going to be lost and then won in the trenches of resistance. And of course, we can't fight that ultimate battle yet until we understand what's going on and we get a lot more people to understand that they're being betrayed by the very government. And this is a very difficult subject for Americans because we're born in the freest nation of the world. We're born with the constitutional heritage that we have. We have grown up under a government where we don't normally have open corruption like you do in Mexico, where you could bribe your way through anything. But not in the United States. We have very little corruption at the local level, very little corruption at the state level, and very little corruption at the mid and lower bureaucratic levels of the federal government. But we have a totally corrupt upper level of government. And that isn't to say that everyone involved in upper-level government knows the full extent of that corruption. But they're part of it because they can't get there without being part of it. And that's part of the problem that we see in today's world is that this great secret combination, of which we're going to talk about three aspects today. I'm going to talk about the world events and how they relate to this. Steve Jones is going to give you specific evidence that points to a major conspiracy involving the 9/11. It's one of the great pieces of evidence that we have. Actually, all of the great cover-ups, whether the Oklahoma City bombing, the JFK assassination, the Martin Luther King assassination, the TW-800 downing, all of these are excellent examples of conspiracy to cover up injustices and provoked terrorist events within our own government. And then Jack Monette is going to give you an introduction based upon his book, his wonderful book, Awakening to Our Awful Situation, of the spiritual basis, the satanic basis of the secret combinations which we face. But you hear it's like speaking to the choir. I know most of you understand the things that I'm going to tell you today, but this is going out on a CD-ROM. It's going to be passed around to people who hopefully you will say, you need to hear this message. So I'm going to give some introductory remarks that will hopefully bring them around to an understanding of what we're dealing with here. First of all, I want to say the most difficult thing we deal with good people, is their inability to perceive wolves masquerading as sheep. It's a very difficult thing for good people to believe in systematic evil. And right now, this is one of the great deceptions that we face in this world. We face a supposed fallen Soviet Union, which in fact is the grandest deception ever pulled off in the history of the world. Communism never fell, ladies and gentlemen. It just went underground. We're also dealing with an administration that claims to be both conservative and Christian, and it is neither. Even though they have chosen as a person to lead it, a very interesting breed of script reader who is at once semi-disingenuous and yet believable to a good many conservatives as a Christian. He's a person who is weak enough mentally that he can actually believe himself that he is both a Christian and a member of Skull and Bones and see no contradiction in those two. And that's a serious problem. He's the most reviled president we've ever had internationally. He's the most despised and unpopular president we've had within this country, despite the fact that in Utah his popularity ratings are the highest in the nation, which is a sad commentary on a people who should have a greater knowledge by the Spirit of the Lord to detect deception. But in fact, there are certain reasons why people from Utah do not detect deception. One is a great deal of wishful thinking, a great deal of training in how to be positive thinkers and not to think negative thoughts, even about government, even when it's right in front of your face. There's also this persecution complex. That is, you come from a persecuted background and you desperately want the acceptance of the world. And the acceptance of the world requires that you not criticize the world. And so Utahns become very, very good at playing along in order to get along. And the world has learned to play the numbers of the Utahns and their delegation in Congress. They've learned how to play the fact that if you don't criticize, we'll give you honors and we'll give you high position. We'll allow you to become secretaries in the cabinet of the United States. We'll give you great honor and glory, because that's what you seek, by the way, as a persecuted people, is it not? To finally gain recognition in the world? And we'll write articles, ubiquitous, pleasant, positive articles about you in Time and Newsweek, praising the progress and the moderation that you've made. And all of that is done specifically to induce you to silence and not to fight against that which is that, as Jack Manette will explain, that Moroni warned us to watch out that this great secret combination does not take over this government, for he has seen it in vision. There's no people on the face of the earth that have a greater heritage and should have a greater heritage but understanding the secret combinations of the last days than the Mormon people. And yet they choose to be blind, most of them. And that's very sad. It's very sad indeed, because when you choose voluntarily to be blind, to choose to live and believe in the illusions of peace and prosperity, then you're only destined to live through the consequences of history. Now, why is it that some other people who are more savvy, more well-educated, are prone to believe in the establishment lies? First of all, the basic problem is, there's one problem, and that's mental laziness. We're all working hard to make a living. Inflation guarantees that none of us can rest. Our money is being robbed, our value is being robbed, and that's done on purpose. The number one purpose of using inflation to finance most of government is so that you don't get taxed for unpopular things. How many of you believe that this war would still be popular this pseudo-patriotic war would still be popular in Utah if every family were paying their fair share of the war every year, $3,000 to $5,000 in additional taxes. You would see a hue and cry go up to Washington to stop this war if people were having to pay taxes, and that is the reason why you're given tax cuts. It's not because they believe in free markets. They want to keep you from feeling the pain of raising taxes for these things. That's the reason why they don't charge the war to you. That's the reason it's off the budget, a special appropriation each year. You need to understand that they never intend to pay off the debt. They, in fact, know that war is coming. They're going to induce war because war is going to get them into the New World Order. And the reason they're not intending to pay off the debt is because war is going to wipe it out. When this country suffers a preemptive nuclear strike, the markets will go to zero and no one will collect. And everyone's going to be left hanging, and there will be a new currency. There will be a new world order because there's no other choice, right? It will drive us into it, that which we would resist. And so there is this wishful thinking on the part of many people, this laziness mentally that we rely, because we have to work so hard, we rely on the news, the free news. Well, it's not free. It comes at a cost. It comes at a cost of your ignorance. The media doesn't so much lie to you. It's what they omit to tell you that is how they distort the news. How many times you have ever heard Channel 5 broadcast stories about the chemtrails that have been had and seen and documented over Utah? How many of you ever seen that on the news? How many of you ever seen a detailed discussion of Stephen Jones' evidence on the 9/11 conspiracy? Well, you've seen news about him being criticized. You've news about Brigham Young University wanting to disavow any allegiance with Professor Jones. But you've never heard the data and the details because it's not considered credible. It's not considered newsworthy. In fact, all that the media has to do is speak the word conspiracy and all of a sudden everyone shudders and withdraws. This is very purposeful to denigrate that word, even though it's very obvious to any student of history that there hasn't been any time in history when it hasn't been full of conspiracy. You can't name me any war where there haven't been conspiring. Now, there's always a superficial reason for war. There's the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand. But who planned the assassination and who was he connected to? Whether it's the assassination of Lincoln or Martin Luther King, these were not lone rogue assassins, as history books tell us. These were all broad-based conspiracies with a great deal of things happening under the table that had to do, in Lincoln's case, with a great deal about covering up for to breaking down the resistance to the carpetbaggers and the things they were going to do to the South. There are many reasons why these things have occurred. But one of the most crucial reasons why people resist being aligned with or discussing conspiracy is that they still want acceptance in the world. I have a good friend who knows in his heart, I know, that there are secret combinations. He's a member of the Mormon Church. He knows about the prophecies. But he continues to deny that any of this exists. And then one time he told me, he said, "You know, Joel, they're going to put you away someday and lock you up and throw away the key." And I said, "You know, it sounds like you believe in conspiracy." Why else would you say to me that they're going to lock away? If you believe that that George Bush is a real Christian and a conservative, why would he lock me up? You see, you know, but the reason why you refuse to believe, the reason why you refuse to acknowledge, is that you still want the acknowledgement of the world in your professional life. And you know, and he writes a newsletter like I do, you know that if you published what I published, you would be blackballed from the establishment people you're still trying to impress. Now, he had no response, because what I said was true. But most of the people that are not here tonight who knew about this did not want to be associated with it because they're still trying to gain the acceptance of the world. And that's why some of the most intelligent people, some of the most well-educated people will never be wise and will never have the courage to fight these battles. Now, if you look around at this audience, you'll see you have a wide range of people. from the educated to the basic, hardworking, blue-collar people. In fact, I would say there's probably a majority of blue-collar people here. Well, blessed are the working class who actually have the courage to not worry about their ego and their reputation so much that they're not afraid to fight this great battle. Because it's on your shoulders, not the educated, sophisticated class, that this battle will rest. And it's with you where the great blessings of heaven will arise, because someday I can tell you that when this new world order is forced upon us through the instrumentality of war, and when good people refuse to take the oath of allegiance that will be required to have your vaunted professional status and to practice law and medicine, those of you who will be willing to work underground, to be willing to do what it takes to help one another, to make it through those times when you're cut off from your economic source of sustenance, that's when you'll need to network. That's when you'll need to know who you can trust. That's who you'll need to know who your neighbor is sitting beside you. Now, I might give a word of advice. One of the things that we must be very careful of if we're going to make it through the very last days and the tribulations is you must be very good at listening to the still small voice of conscience that will warn you in advance of things coming. Because I will tell you that you will not get warning of what I'm going to predict from pulpits in any of the churches of this world. The Lord is not going to warn this people through pulpits if they just sit there and do nothing. It is those people who have learned to sense that something's wrong when everyone tells them that it's all right, that are going to be warned in their hearts and are going to know that they must prepare. And you will be ridiculed for some of those preparations. Because if you think that only food storage is going to do it, you're kidding yourself. When nuclear weapons and biological and chemical weapons come down upon this nation, it's not just food storage that will save you. You must have the preparation to get out of high-density population areas. You must have the preparations to secure and seal yourself off from the contaminants for a period of time until they clear up. So that's something that you all need to do. And I realize that some of these things require money. Not as much as you think, though. You, in this room, are capable of doing a lot of your own work. You just have to be willing to do so. But I congratulate you for what you've done so far. But I will say that some of you, if not many of you, are selectively receptive to the voice of conscience. And that is, you're very carefully receptive to the voice that warned you about these secret combinations, to that you're to be congratulated. But many of you here are overweight. You resist the speakings of conscience to lose weight, to be more careful about what you eat. Your health and your life will depend on it. Many of you have lost your children because you put them in public schools instead of going through the hardship of homeschooling or private schooling. And if you can't afford private schooling, you can homeschool. You've lost a lot of your children because you've rationalized that it's okay, that I can overcome the education. Well, you may be able to overcome the bad education, but you don't overcome the peer pressure and the great evils of the social influences that they receive. What I'm just saying is that you've got to listen to the full range of the voice of the conscience to be worthy of receiving the full range of warnings someday, of which you'll depend upon to make it through these very last days, because you will not depend and not be able to depend on establishment sources. Now let me say that one of the greatest arguments that has been used against those who believe in conspiracy theories is one that, with a great snicker in their voice, they say, "Now come now. Certainly there could never be a worldwide conspiracy to take away liberty. It would require thousands of people having knowledge of this, and you'd never be able to keep it a secret." How many times have you heard that argument? You hear that every time you interview somebody, and the only people they interview, by the way, on television are people who debunk conspiracy. Or you get an incredible individual up there. They don't ask people up there who really know what they're talking about. They don't give them the time of day. But debunkers of conspiracy will always give you that argument that this is just laughable. But I'll tell you why it isn't laughable. If they'd ever really thought through it very well about how conspiracies operate, they'd understand, first of all, that you never do tell many people about the full range of conspiracy. First of all, you talk and you maybe admit that there's a control system, but you tell people it's benevolent. Then you also hire a lot of predictable people so that you don't have to tell them what's going on. If you're in the news media, how many times do you hire conservative commentators like myself to work for the news media? You never get hired because you're up against what the editors want. I've talked to enough reporters, even at the Deseret News, who, when you get them in private, agree with many of the things that Steve Jones said. And I say, why don't you write about it? Oh, my editor would never accept it. Well, why don't you quit? Well, you know, my job, my career, all of this, I've got to make a living. You know, they have all these excuses. You see, people, journalists will never admit that they are, in fact, very much coerced into doing what they do. But it's not overt. It's not saying, look, this is the bottom line. We're a conspiracy. We're not going to have this truth and this truth, etc. They simply hire predictable people. They can smell a constitutional conservative just like you could smell a liberal. They know when they're in the presence of one. They interview me differently than they interview someone like Mitt Romney, who's trying to please the world, you see. And so they hire predictable people. This is very important in the selective process of promoting people. They provide also lots of money, perks, and positive incentives for people for going along with the system. Then when they start to ask too many questions, and eventually there are among honest people that ask too many questions, they'd say, now look, first of all, this is a matter of national security. National security is the most wonderful boon to conspiracy that was ever invented, because you can tell honest people, this is a matter of national security. You don't really need to know about this, but you can trust us. And your job's on the line if you don't trust us. And so what do? I can't tell you how many people from Utah I've had who work in Washington. When I was chairman of the Conservative National Committee, would say to me, you know, Brother Skousen, what you say just can't be true. I'm in the FBI. I would know. I would know if there was a conspiracy. I'm in the CIA, Brother Scouse. I would know. They don't understand there's a white side of the FBI and a black side. There's a white side of the CIA and a black side. And they're on the white side. They love to hire Mormons on the white side of the CIA and government agencies. They're so believable. And they're so naive about believing. They're so trusting of their leadership. And it's just stacked with them. And I'll tell you, I had an opportunity when I was in Washington. I got a call from a doctor in Texas who had a client who was confessed to him that he was an agent for the FBI, that he had infiltrated CSPES, which was the Committee in Solidarity of the People of El Salvador, a communist front in Texas made up of Salvadoran communists that were, and the FBI had infiltrated it through a Latino, and the Latino came to him and said, as they were talking politics, and he realized this doctor knew a lot more than normal people, and he opened up to him and he said, look, I've got a problem. My FBI handler hasn't been paying me. I found out there's a conspiracy within this front organization to assassinate President Reagan, and all of a sudden he's stonewalling. He's not paying me. He didn't want any information from me. What's going on? You know, I'm poor. I need to get paid. So he calls me up and he says, Joel, can you look into this? And I had contacts in the CIA, and I said, well, look, I'll need to know this guy's code name. So he got his code name for me, and so I called my friend in the CIA, and I said, look, see if you can find out what's going on with this contact. He says, look, there's very little chance that this is just one small two-timer informer down in Dallas, Texas, that the headquarters are going to know about it, but I'll call FBI and find out if they know anything about it. He no more than uttered that guy's code name than all hell broke loose in the FBI office up there in Washington. Not only did this know this guy, they wanted to know from my friend, the CIA agent, how did you find out? He called me back in a panic and said, look, I'm going to have to tell them, you know, your name, because my career is on the line now. This is a hornet's nest. They know who this guy is. And then there's a problem. And so I said, well, listen, you just send the FBI out to talk to me and we'll get you off the hook. They came out, two white shirt, clean cut FBI from the white side coming out to interview me. And I said, look, I'm trying to get this guy paid. I want to know why he's being stonewalled, why he's got information relative to the assassination attempt on President Reagan, why the FBI isn't interested in it. And they said, look, we got to know every person who knows this guy's code name. We got to know who you found out from. We want the whole chain. I said, I'm not going to give that to you. I said, I want help for this guy. And so the guy said, excuse me, can I use your phone? I said, sure. He goes back. I could hear him on the telephone. No, he won't tell me. Look, I know, but I can't get this out of him. I mean, what do you want me to do, arrest him? And so it's obvious this guy didn't know the whole reason why he was trying to get this out. He just was told he had to get it out of me. And so we ended at a stalemate, but I went back there and I flew down to Dallas and decided to interview this guy. Since I spoke fluent Spanish, I could talk to him and find out what the real story was. He told me a very interesting story. He said, you know, when I was being trained for this undercover job, my FBI handler brought me to a party one evening with other agents in the government. And he had a few drinks, and he was a little loose, and he told me all this in Spanish, and he said, that guy's CIA, and that guy's INS, and that guy's DA, and we all have this ring on. Because, you know, Congress doesn't really know we exist. We have our own budget, we have our own operations center, and we have this organization that does whatever we want. You can be part of that someday if you play your cards right. So he was trying to recruit him, basically. But you see, ladies and gentlemen, this is what the news media ran into in 1994 when they had the nigger hanging tree incident. They found a big multi-jurisdictional task force party on the 4th of July, and they had this, there were all these government agents there, and they had this nigger hanging tree, and they were selling raffle tickets to see who could go and attend this mock hanging, and they were throwing out all these racial epithets. And there was one of these people who was not a full-fledged agent that had invited along like my contact was. And he went and told the press about it. And the press got news of this, and they started spreading this all over. You may have read about this. A good old boys network is what they called it. It was a good old boys party. You know, the press never asked, what were all of these different agents doing? All they were concerned about was the racial issue. No one asked the question, what were different agencies doing having a party together at government expense? What they'd run across was the same thing this contact had. They ran into the dark side of government. They ran into the dark side of enforcement. This is the enforcement side of the secret combination. And many whistleblowers come out of the dark side, or having seen too much in the dark side, and they think the CIA has a coup on this government. The CIA really runs things, and they're wrong. They too, even having seen the black side, can't believe that in fact the people at the very top are running them rather than the CIA running the people at the top. People who generally criticize, and the sources that we rely on in the alternative news are often from the left, and the left has a built-in bias to believe that because our government is free market, therefore it's capitalist, and it's greedy capitalist, and therefore it's greedy capitalism that is what this is all about. But it isn't. Globalists who are running this government through the puppet George W. Bush are socialists. A different breed than communists, but socialists nevertheless. They believe in milking the free market in order to pay for socialist benefits instead of communists, which believe in killing the free market, which doesn't work. The third way, British Fabianism, is what works, at least for a longer term. Now, I'm about out of time, so I need to cut this a little bit short. But before I close, I want to give you a brief overview of my general theory of what this conspiracy is up to. Ultimately, it is about taking away national sovereignty. Now, you say, why would they have to take away national sovereignty with a war, which is part of my national theory, or my general theory, if in fact they're doing just fine now with NAFTA, GATT, the North American Union, the FTA, all of these regional things, the EU, these are all globalist organizations that slowly are Sovietizing the various governments within nations. Well, there comes a point, ladies and gentlemen, when you reach an immigration crisis, when the people just say no with such a loud shout that they can't get away with it without getting impeached, without getting lynched. You realize the Capitol Hill switchboards were swamped? They couldn't even operate for 3 days because the people were so irate? When a go-along man, a yes-man supreme like Senator Orrin Hatch, can't vote for this immigration even though he desperately wants to, you know that even Utahns have woken up to the immigration scandal. And it's about time. But he has not been converted. Orrin Hatch is still sold out to pleasing the Bush administration because he's been promised years ago false promises that he could run for president if he'd play along. They gave him his chance. You notice how that went. They promised he would also get a nomination to the Supreme Court, and he didn't get that. He's been betrayed twice now from the promises. I'm sure they've got other things they're leading him along with. But that's how they deal with people who aren't necessarily evil. Many congressmen, they have dirt on them. They have their immoral escapades. They have their gay escapades that they blackmail them with. When you've got our Utah congressional delegation, they can't blackmail them with very much. Most of these people are pretty straight arrows. But so they lure them along with the, we can help your people get ahead. We can make you look good. We can make your state look good. We can make your church look good. You staying in Washington will be good for everything that you honor. And they think they're on a mission from God to compromise because they believe that staying in power is doing the will of God, even if that means compromising the very principles and corrupting their very conservative constituency, which they do every day. Now, what their real purpose is, you know, my point was about their slow progress in bringing us into a new world order through regional government, is that at some point you're going to offend a majority of people. They have a written rule right now. You don't offend the majority at any given time. Only offend minorities. You got close to it during 9/11 when you started shutting down transportation. People were getting really hopping mad. In fact, terrorism hardly ever affects anyone but a few hundred people. What affects you in terrorism is the government reaction to terrorism. Look at Katrina. That was a disaster made by government. What's the lesson that people have learned out of Katrina? Don't go into a FEMA camp, ever. Don't go to FEMA. Because you become in a prison camp and you can't get out. And that's what happened in the Superdome. Don't get on a freeway managed by FEMA. It becomes a prison camp and you can't get out. Stay off the roads, stay off and away from the population densities. Now, when they eventually get to the point where you're going to put together a new world order, eventually they're going to have to start imposing these rules and regulations upon the world of which we are not used to accepting. And Americans don't like this kinds of thing. They don't like being hauled before a wetlands court in Belgium to hire an international attorney to defend yourself against a wetlands violation in Utah. How many people are going to start to rebel when that happens? How many people are going to start to demand to Congress, get us out of this new world order? They know this is coming. They know Americans won't take voluntarily going into a new world order when it starts to inconvenience them, when they start to have to pay international taxes, when they start to have religious and gay rights imposed upon them. That's why they plan on giving you war. And here's how they plan to do it. First of all, they intend to antagonize the world. And that's the process that you're seeing right now. Yes, they're in the Middle East for oil, but that's a secondary consideration. The only general line of thought that connects between Bosnia and all of the intervention in Kosovo, etc., was to make the Slavic people angry at Americans. And now we're in the Middle East to make the Muslim people hate Americans all over the world. Now, why is that? Because it's the Slavic people and the Muslim people that are the two basic client demographic groups that are the client states of the old Soviet Union and the current Russia. That's the ones that Russia used to arm, and where they had all of their terrorists through them. So they're arming or creating hatred among these states, so that the U.S. becomes the most hated government in the world. You know, what President Bush says is a bunch of disinformation, at least what his script writers do. They don't hate our freedoms. They don't hate our lifestyles. The Muslims in Iran and Saudi Arabia are trying to imitate Western lifestyles as fast as they can get stuff through the black market. What they hate is our government interfering with them. They hate the black aspects of the CIA. And our government's piling it on time after again. And that's why they picked George Bush. They picked George Bush not only because he was a believable dupe for conservatives. They picked him because he was laughable to the international community. He doesn't know it yet, but he's been picked to take all of the blame for everything that's going to go wrong in the world. His own people, the globalists who picked him to run for president, he will someday find out they were the ones who picked him to take the whole blame. Even as Al Gore suddenly realized that he was betrayed by the establishment who he thought was going to rush him into the presidency. You see, these people use their own people. They can't trust them because this is a conspiracy writ large. Now, what we're building is an enemy to the whole world and our own government. And the reason this is necessary, in fact, we're handing the Russians and the Chinese, which are the real axis of evil, the wherewithal to build. We're giving them the preemptive excuse to use a strike. I think there'll be a trigger event prior to this Third World War, which will be a minor use of nuclear weapons. It may come in Iran. When you open Pandora's box and suddenly you start to use nuclear weapons, and notice who will use them first, either Israel or the U.S., then suddenly, who is then justified in the eyes of the world in nuking the United States? Russia and China. We weren't the first use. The U.S. started the doctrine of preemption. The U.S. used the doctrine of preemption in Iraq. They used the doctrine of preemption in Iran. And if they nuke the nuclear facilities in Iran with a low-grade nuclear weapon, which they probably will have to do to be able to penetrate it, now you're open and we're exposed to nuclear weapons. That is for a retaliatory strike. It's the mother of all terrorism, our own government, inducing a nuclear strike. It answers the question of why the United States government, why our intelligence agency have been covering for the Russians for so many years. You think our government didn't know that the fall of the Soviet Union was a fraud? You don't think they didn't know that the KGB, the phony attempt to capture Gorbachev in his undefended villa, was a fraud? The KGB has done the most secret, sophisticated assassination jobs in the world, and they couldn't capture Gorbachev in an unattended villa. When the heads of the KGB and the GRU and the defense minister fled after the coup, who were they fleeing from? These are the supposed heads of all the power in the Soviet Union. Not one journalist asked the question, who were they fleeing from? Why doesn't this make sense? They didn't ask the question, who were these people 2 years ago? They were mid-level bureaucrats. How did they suddenly become heads of these most powerful agencies? It's because they really weren't the heads any more than George Bush is the head of this country. There are secret combinations which control, and they use puppets. And they use second-level people like the Kissingers, the Strobe Talbots, the Brent Scowcroft, who was honored here at Brigham Young University. Gaddy Anton's all, ladies and gentlemen. And we gave honor to them. We gave honor to a vice president who's a Gaddy Ant, and I will say that for the camera. Someday people will be very embarrassed, innocent though they may be, or though they may wish to remain, when they go up to heaven and Lord puts his arm around them and said, I'm sorry to tell you that the people you admired most and gave honors to at my university were Gaddy Ants. Talk about embarrassment. Really embarrassed. But these are not evil people that I'm criticizing this. These are people who are willingly decided to be blind, willingly decided to reject the many letters and emails you get which try to influence them and get them to the sea light because they want to please the world. That was my major criticism of Brigham Young University my whole time there. Every one of those professors wanted to make it in the world. And that's why I had the most liberal socialist experience as a political science major at Brigham Young University. I was absolutely disgusted. I had to unlearn all that I learned in order to be what I am today. But I will tell you to end, sometime, probably the middle of the next decade at the earliest, there's going to be a nuclear preemptive strike on America from Russia and China. And Russia is not quite ready, and China's about 6 or 7 years from being ready. China will take the eastern Pacific, including Australia, New Zealand, Japan, Philippines, North Korea, South Korea, all of that will be under China's control. So don't think about relocating to New Zealand for safety. You don't want to live under a Chinese occupation. But I'll tell you, when our leaders come out of their bunkers, out of that nuclear preemptive strike, they will continue the deception. They won't tell you that Joel Skousen was right, that the Russians really never did give up communism. They will say, the Russians deceived us. We never realized that they weren't our allies. They'll continue to play the game. And they'll say, but you know, we have no military anymore. It's all been nuked. We've got to resurrect our power and strength in the name of God, country, and the Constitution. They'll use those holy words and go say, we must join with the United Nations, though, now to fight this great Third World War. And Americans stupidly will get behind that patriotic fervor, just as they have been fooled and duped into the stupid patriotism of 9/11. And they will back this New World Order right into the large globalism that they have so normally would have resisted. And that's how we'll get a New World Order. And during that New World Order, sometime, they will turn against those who will resist, like you and I, with a test oath. And they'll say, there are too many traitors among us in America. There are too many people who resist and who are undermining our government and undermining our troops who are serving so valiantly to fight against the communist menace. You can hear it all, can't you? And you will be tagged. And your neighbors will be asked to turn you in. Those who have spoken out against it, it will take great courage. But do not fear, because if you have courage, the Lord will sustain you. This is the battle. The Book of Mormon conspiracy and the Gadians knew nothing compared to the sophistication of what you and I are going to go through in the last days. Now, I don't pretend to know all the answers, but I know that this war is coming. And I know that there is no resolution politically of what we're dealing with. Though we must continue to try, we must not stop trying, because in that trying, we convert other people. And in that trying, we allow the Lord to judge those who are betraying our liberties, either through weakness or through forethought of knowledge. Well, it's been a pleasure to speak with you today. There's much more that we could talk about. I encourage you to get Jack's book. He's a marvelous, courageous individual. You're going to enjoy Professor Stephen Jones, give you the specific data that will show you that this 9/11 official version was a fraud. I thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure to be with you today.
Talk I've heard ever. My next speaker, Brother Stephen Jones, tell you a little bit about him. He has his PhD in physics, mathematics, electronics minors from Vanderbilt University in 1978, retaining tuition scholarship and a research fellowship. He has his postdoctoral research conducted at Cornell University and the Los Alamos Mason Physics Facility. He has been awarded the David O. McKay Scholarship at Brigham Young University. He has been on a mission to France, Belgium. He's been a counselor in two bishoprics. He's been on the State High Council, the Young Men's President, and the Bishop. He has written over 50 peer-reviewed scientific publications, including in Scientific American, Nature 3 times, and Physical Review Letters. And I'm happy to present Stephen Jones to you.
Tim is setting up the camera there. I'm going to set up my computer. That didn't work. Okay. Now let's see if this is going to fly. It was just over 2 years ago in this very room that I had my real introduction to 9/11 as being something other than Al-Qaeda and the Muslims did it, and we have to go get them now. The occasion was a talk by Sarah Monet, and Sarah, during her remarks, some of you know Sarah. Okay, I can't turn up that. I can't turn it up, but I can maybe hug it a little bit. Sarah, in her remarks, she paused and she said, "Now, if you think that those towers came down just because they were hit by planes, you have some major surprises ahead of you." And the audience broke into applause, or about half the audience, and I was of the half that was looking around thinking, well, what in the world is she talking about? Now, I had had some nudges from friends, one of whom is here tonight, to look at the events, hi Steve, of 9/11 scientifically and with a critical eye, as I've been trained as a scientist. And after Sarah's talk, I did. I was not teaching that spring, and so this is in 2005. So I got online and started looking. Now, I saw for the first time the collapse of World Trade Center 7, which is being shown behind me here on the screen. This is a 47-story skyscraper. I'm going to start my timer because I've got a certain time here to hold to. 47-story skyscraper in downtown Manhattan. I'll show you its location. It's part of the World Trade Center complex. Was not hit by a jet, and yet at 5:20 in the afternoon it came down, as you can see. It comes straight down very rapidly, completely collapses, never hit by a jet. Is that clear? Now, I'd like to know, how many of you is this the first time that you've seen Building 7 collapse? Let me just see. Okay, there's quite a few. Last weekend I was in Vancouver, Canada, speaking about 9/11 at a conference there, and I think there were just two in the audience who had not seen Building 7 collapse. So that's quite a number. If this is your first introduction, I hope you will take a closer look here with me tonight, and I'll show you some places where you can get some more information in addition. I shifted my talk around a little bit as we were going along here. I decided I would start with President Packer commenting at a devotional at BYU earlier this year in January. And let me just read a little bit from President Packer to set the stage. Moroni warned us that the secret combinations begun by Gaddy Anton, quoting now from the Book of Mormon, are had among all people. Wherefore, O ye Gentiles. Now, at this point, President Packer pauses and he interjects his own comment. And the term Gentile in that place in the Book of Mormon refers to us in our generation. Speaking to you now, in other words, okay. It is wisdom in God that these things should be shown unto you, that thereby ye may repent of your sins and suffer not that these murderous combinations shall get above you. Wherefore the Lord commandeth you. This is not a suggestion, you know. And I remember President Benson saying, it sounds like Moroni here is a little bit worried that we won't catch on. You know, so a commandment, when you shall see these things come among you, that you shall awake to a sense of your awful situation. Of course, this is the basis of the title of Jack Manette's book. Because of this secret combination which shall be among you. Not maybe, not, you know, maybe, possibly. No, it shall be among you. He went on, I'm just quoting obviously parts of President Packer's talk. You who are young will see many things that will try your courage and test your faith. All of the mocking does not come from outside of the church. Let me say that again. I'm quoting President Packer. All of the mocking does not come from outside of the church. Be careful that you do not fall into the category of mocking. The Lord promised, if you are prepared, you shall not fear. I'm glad that my calling and my ward now is preparedness, emergency preparedness committee, because, it's just what I'm trying to encourage. I talk to a lot of people who are not Latter-day Saints about year supply and about a three-month rotating food supply. I hope you've heard about that. It's in the pamphlet now that was announced at the last general conference. I'll talk more about that at the end. In case you missed that, three-month rotating food supply. I talk to people about that, and I'll tell you, there's a lot of non-LDS, good people who are very interested in preparing, getting their food storage so they don't have to worry so much anyway, and so that they're ready. And this is the key. If you are prepared, the Lord said, you shall not fear. Now, finishing up by Elder Packer last January at BYU. You live in an interesting generation where trials will be constant in your life. Learn to follow the promptings of the Holy Ghost. It's what Joel mentioned as well. This is the key to getting through this interesting time period, looking forward to the second coming of Christ. And it comes to mind, the Book of Mormon, in those decades before the coming of Christ, President Benson and others pointed out, we'll see many parallels to our day. I hope you can see them. The Gadiant robbers, Helaman 6 and 7, right on through, actually, till 3 Nephi 11. Raising children in a world that is turned upside down. You will face many great and tumultuous and difficult things in your life. But then, he says, you will also enjoy great inspiration and joy in your life. And that's the context I approach this. As we work together, as we're prepared, we can, and follow the promptings of the Holy Ghost, we can have that inspiration and find joy, even in difficult times. Think of what's at the end of the tunnel here. Right, okay. I'll see you in Missouri if I don't see you in Missouri. We're on a path of truth here tonight. And the following, what follows truth is justice. Hopefully, there will be justice ultimately, if not in this life, and peace depends on truth. Patrick Henry put it this way, in a similar period in the America's history in many ways, 1775. We are apt to shut our eyes against a painful truth. But is this the part of wise men engaged in a great and arduous struggle for liberty? For my part, and I hope this will be your part, whatever anguish of spirit it might cost, I am willing to know the whole truth and to know it now. And the greatest of all, in my opinion, said, who lived on this earth, the truth shall make you free. Right, so that's the goal. Time is passing very quickly. don't look, Carol, at the time. The first of the items I want to bring to your attention is we look at the events of 9/11 scientifically as the complete collapse. Fortunately, I already showed you the collapse of Building 7. It's on the right. On the left, you see an inferno that engulfed a high-rise in Madrid, Spain. The building, as you see, did not collapse. In fact, there are zero examples of high-rise buildings collapsing due to fire. This building also had concrete in it. The World Trade Center towers and Building 7 were steel frame buildings, strictly. But I show this Madrid building so you can see the inferno that was there. Look at Building 7. Do you see a tremendous inferno there? There were some random fires in the building. We'll talk more about that. But notice that this building did not collapse. After the fire was out, it was still standing. That's what has happened in every other case of high-rise buildings like this, steel-frame buildings. A piece of it, though, did slough off. So you'd say there was a partial collapse not a complete collapse of the building. And it also we find that the Building 7 falls at nearly free fall speed, the roof, as it begins its steady decline. So here we see a photo of World Trade Center 7. Let me see if I can get that on the screen for you. That's just about right. On the afternoon of 9/11. So you see, looking now from the rubble where the World Trade Center building stood, look, and here's Building 7 standing in the afternoon. It fell 7 hours after the towers had collapsed. The distance from the nearest tower, which is the North Tower, to the Building 7 is about 100 meters, 100 yards, about a football field length away across the street. And now, as you can see, the collapse is complete. On the right, we have a controlled demolition. I suppose all of us have seen controlled demolitions. The goal of a controlled demolition in general is to bring that building straight down onto its footprint, precisely what happened with Building 7. Of course, that trick is accomplished in controlled demolition using explosives to get material out of the way so that the roof can crawl down and fall very rapidly. The 9/11 Commission report, supposedly a complete discussion of events of 9/11, failed to even mention the collapse of Building 7. The FEMA report, is the first official report on these collapses, stated, our best hypothesis, which is fire with some damage for Building 7, has only a low probability of occurrence. Let's give them credit for honesty there. We've been joined in this worldwide truth movement now, 9/11 truth movement, by a number of people, including some structural professors in Switzerland at ETH, which is equivalent roughly of our MIT. In my opinion, says Hugo Bachmann, WTC-7 was with the highest probability brought down by controlled demolition done by experts. People were excluded that day. You don't have Al-Qaeda agents running in and setting explosives to bring the building down on 9/11. George Schneider, this is in a newspaper over in Europe, another professor emeritus, structural analysis, said World Trade Center 7 was with the great probability brought down by explosives. There are now over 140 architects and engineers in the group called Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. In the group that I'm a member of, there are over 440 scholars now, 9/11 scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice. STJ911.org. And basically, if you are willing to read, not just looking at videos is fine, if you're willing to read the articles in the Journal of 9/11 Studies, which I'll talk about more, then we invite you to join this. So let me put that up there again. STJ911.org. And help spread the word about 9/11. I want to quote something that just came out, Loose Change. Many of you have seen this DVD. It's by some young men who have put together a number of evidences regarding 9/11. And they recently released from their movie, they're planning a regular movie for theaters that should be out hopefully towards the end of this year. Quoting from a security guard, an interview, he was asked to go into Building 7 in the morning. Now, this is after the first tower had been hit, but before the second tower was hit. He was asked to go in and escort someone up to the 23rd floor, which they did. When they got up there, the place was evacuated, and so they started going down. And now, quoting from this security guard, we subsequently went to the stairwell and were going down the stairs. When we reached the sixth floor, the landing we were standing on gave way, There was an explosion, and the landing gave way. I was left there hanging. I had to climb back up, and now had to walk back up to the eighth floor. And they were able, from the eighth floor, to find another way out. So there was an explosion, and obviously very damaging, because their stairway was destroyed below them. Now this is interesting, because NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technology, which was tasked to explain the collapse of these World Trade Center buildings, when it gets to World Trade Center 7, their report is long overdue. And just today, now let me back up. It was supposed to be out December of last year. Then they said spring of this year. Well, it's passed. And so just today, NIST had a press release saying, well, they plan to have it out by the end of this year now. Well, it's long overdue. Anyway, they subcontracted to a company in Albuquerque, ARA, to analyze the collapse of Building 7. And here's the restrictions that they put in this solicitation. NIST asked them to create detailed floor analyses to determine likely modes of failure for floors 8 to 46 due to failure of one or more supporting columns in World Trade Center 7. Now, why would they restrict them, you know, floor 8 and above? Well, we just read this fellow, he's coming down. The explosion was below him. Below, when they got back to floor 8, they were okay. They could find another way out. Aha. They also comment today, of course I added this today, NIST has found no evidence of a blast or controlled demolition event. Well, evidently that may be true if you stop yourself above floor 8. As a scientist, I want to know, well, what happens below floor 8? And we're finding out. Unfortunately, they're not looking at the whole picture, are they, when they limit that view from floors 8 to 46. Already gives us a pause. Furthermore, NIST, despite Freedom of Information Act requests, they've refused to release the videos and photos that they have, which they acquired from taxpayers at taxpayer expense, you know, mostly from taxpayers, people taking videos. They refused to release any photos of Building 7. We would like to get that released. So if that's something we can work toward, I would recommend that we do that. Let's see, I'll skip that. Let's see. You'll have to read about some of this by going to the Journal of 9/11 Studies. I will point out just a couple of things. There was in this building a secret CIA office, also offices of the Department of Defense. So this is a highly secure building. It's not one that terrorists could just run into and set explosives. The owner / leaseholder of the World Trade Center buildings insured these buildings, the World Trade Center, against terrorist attack 6 weeks, just about 6 weeks before 9/11, before the terrorist attack. And the payout in insurance was about $4.6 billion. We could say more about that, but you'll have to read some of this, as I say, because you're scholars, right? And so as you read. The World Trade Center towers, moving along to those, are very solidly constructed, as you might imagine, with 47 core columns. Here are the core columns up close, and 240 perimeter columns. These are not hollow tubes, as I have heard argued from structural engineers who should know better. We now have the release of the architectural plans, by the way. That came out just earlier this year. Quick story on that. A professor in Colorado sent them to me. He'd worked with the insurance companies. And, oh, thank you very much, Jack. It gave me a little more time. Appreciate it. I'll give you 10 minutes sometime, maybe. Anyway, this professor in Colorado had worked with the insurance companies, during this discussion, the trials, actually, to see how much would be paid out to Mr. Silverstein and company. And so he had access to these architectural plans. He sent them to me on a disc, and he said, I'd like these to be made public, but not my name, to be made public. So they are now public. And, you know, we're glad to help get that information out. So there's no question, these are not hollow tubes. We have the detailed plans. I put a stove here to remind you, this is steel. Here's structural steel. And I have a wood-burning stove. And, you know, I'm not worried about it melting on me or collapsing either. Steel melts at 1538 centigrade, plus or minus a little, depending on what alloys you use. And fires reach a maximum temperature of about 1100 centigrade. And this NIST report included that. They say there's no way this melted. No, that's not the problem. We look at conservation momentum in analyzing the collapse of these buildings. Again, just like the World Trade Center 7, the collapse is too rapid unless there are explosives moving the material out of the way. This diagram is from a paper by Dr. Leggy in the Journal of 911 Studies.com. And his argument is a rather easy one to understand. You take the upper block of 16 floors, so just below where the planes went in, and you say, okay, we'll give it to NIST. We'll let it start to collapse. Okay, somehow, all those 287 columns give way more or less simultaneously, so the thing starts to move down, this upper block. Okay, we'll grant that, even though we have our doubts about that, too. But now what happens? See? The rest of the building is there. It is not designed to give up when something moves. It's designed to stand. In fact, it's designed to withstand hurricane force winds. And also, by the way, a collision of a 707. That was designed. Boeing 707, back in the days when these were designed and then built. So the question he raises is, which is going to fall faster? The block that falls in air or the block that has approximately 300,000 tons of concrete and steel beams, 287 support columns, in the way? This is not a trick question. You see, obviously, the one falling in air should fall faster. But in fact, what's observed is the roof falls at nearly free fall speed, as if there's nothing in the way. Now, how do you do that? You know, we've all experienced conservation momentum, which is when you're driving in your car and you hit something, you slow down. Okay. Now, when you hit 300,000 tons of steel and concrete, by George, you're going to slow down, you know, on the way down. And Professor Cutler, are you here tonight, Ken, by any chance, did a paper looking at how long it would take for the towers to collapse, and he's getting upwards of 30 seconds. Well, they collapsed in about 12, plus or minus 2 or 3 seconds, you see. Way too fast. Now, how do you do the trick, then, to get them collapsed so fast? You move material out of the way. Gordon Ross also writes about this. Depending on the safety factor that was present in the buildings, you know, they're designed to stand not just a factor of one, but 2 or 3 times, that like that, the weight. Anyway, they might not have collapsed at all. They might not have collapsed at all, is the argument. If you look at conservation of energy and momentum, read the paper by Gordon Ross on that one. If we look at the data, they completely collapse. Now, looking at the towers after the collapse, the cores are gone. This is not a pancake collapse. On the right, you see an actual pancake collapse due to an earthquake in Asia where, you have the floors stacked up. This is not the case with the towers. You know, instead, they were pulverized. And how do you do that without explosives? See? It's not taking a PhD to figure this out. Now, how does NIST handle this problem? How does NIST handle this problem where all the data goes against the official story of, you know, fires caused, and then gravity, the thing just gives up and straight down in 12 seconds. You know, how do they do? Here's the trick that they use. They take you and they put this in a report with like 10,000 pages of report. They take you only to the point where the towers are poised for collapse. Their term. Quote, poised for collapse. In other words, they ignore the speed of collapse, the completeness of the collapse, the squibs, the expulsions of air and debris, and so on. All these signs that we recognize. Now, if you're looking at a controlled demolition, before it goes off, Can you tell it's going to go off, that there are explosives in there? Well, unless you know that there, you couldn't. But when it goes, you can tell, because it goes straight down completely and very fast. That's just what happened. It has all the characteristics of controlled demolition. Folks, this is not rocket science. And there are, as I say, structural engineers joining. Now, Besant just came out with a paper, and his few joined him. They say this upper block, I'm going to have to go a little faster, must remain as a tamper to knock the buildings down. When I first saw this, I thought, man, wait a minute, Newton's third law, which I try to drill in, you know, to the students, means that if there's a force down, there's an equal and opposite force up. So the force on the upper block is just as great, it's equal to the force down. Okay, now I know it's hard to believe, but that's Newton's third law. I could go through, it's a conservation momentum argument, finally. But the upper columns have thinner support columns. They're thinning out as they go up, plus the fire was heating. So what do you expect? Well, you expect the upper block to disintegrate first, not to remain intact, as they require in their paper. Okay, so let's look at the actual data. Slowed down, looking at the upper block here, north tower. Is it remaining as an intact block, or is it disintegrating before your eyes here? It's disintegrating. It's gone. Okay, so much for the collapse of the towers. Complete and rapid. Easy to remember. Never happened before that way, you see. Partial collapse, yes, that's what we expect. Okay. Lack of air defenses, my point number two. And I am... Okay, I'm going to need that, Jack, but okay, here we go. did that ever bother you like it does me now as I think about that? Wow, where were our airplanes defending our capital and New York City on 9/11? Associated Press points out the scrambling of fighter aircraft at the first sign of trouble. So when a jet goes off course, they scramble jets to accompany it, see what's wrong, help it if they can. In the year period before 9/11, fighters were scrambled 67 times. On 9/11, how many interceptions of those four jets did we have? As far as we know, zero. Okay, that's what they tell us. NORAD spokesman says the fighters routinely intercept aircraft. When planes are intercepted, they are handled with a graduated response. So they try to bring it down if it's really intercepted. I mean, you know, help it to land. Okay, here's a Russian commander-in-chief of the Russian Air Force. Generally, this is the day after 9/11. It is impossible to carry out an act of terror on the scenario which was used in the USA yesterday. As soon as something like that happens here, I am reported about that right away, and in a minute, we are all up. In other words, what was going on? You know, I'd like to know. So here's some data. You won't have time to digest all of this, I'm sure, but let me point out, first of all, it's United and American Airlines, those are the two involved. After the first crash, which was 8:46, we suspected something. The second crash, 9:03, we knew something was wrong. The plane that was headed towards the Pentagon went off course at 8:46, and the crash on the Pentagon was 9:38. 52 minutes later. Folks, that is plenty of time. Why was not this plane intercepted? This is serious and suggests that there's somebody knowing what's going on. So let's see. Norman Mineta testified to the 9/11 Commission that he went down to the Presidential Emergency Operations Center. This is a bunker underneath the White House on 9/11 in the morning. Vice President Cheney was there and was in charge. Now we're going to quote. We're going to quote from Secretary Mineta. We have this on videotape, but the 9/11 Commission report did not include this in their report. Just like they didn't include the collapse of Building 7. So it's important, right? Okay, so pay attention. During the time the airplane was coming into the Pentagon, Secretary Mineta, there was a young man who would come in and say to the Vice President, "The plane is 50 miles out." Plenty of time for interception. "The plane is 30 miles out." Still enough time. When it got down to the plane is 10 miles out, the young man also said to the vice president, "Do the orders still stand?" Now, this is a conscientious young man. He's worried. These orders, I mean, he's concerned. What? That's why he's asking. Do these orders still stand? And the vice president turned and whipped his neck around and said, "Of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary?" And about 3 minutes later, then there was the collision with the Pentagon, and hundreds of people lost their lives without any warning, according to April Gallup, who was in the Pentagon that morning and managed to survive. She was knocked out. My wife and I heard her speak in California, was that February? And she was there with her baby, by the way. It's an interesting story. I won't go into the detail, but she said there was no warning. And she wants to know why there was no alert. They knew, 50 miles out, plenty of time to alert them as well as to scramble a jet. Not only was there no interception, there was no warning to the people in the Pentagon. Now, why in the world wouldn't they tell the people, there's something coming your way, clear the building, you got time? Yeah. 10, 15 minutes, just get out of there. The FBI seized videotapes from nearby hotels and businesses minutes after the hit. Only certain things have been released. We would like to have those videos released. If there's nothing to hide, why hide it? Release the videos, please, so we can see what actually hit the Pentagon and what was going on that day. I won't go into a great deal of detail, except to say that what has been released does not show a plane. It shows just a nose cone that is too close to the ground, if this were, in fact, a Boeing 757, according to the official story. Okay. President Putin said on the 15th, 4 days after 9/11, "I ordered my intelligence to warn President Bush in the strongest terms before 9/11 that 25 terrorists were getting ready to attack the U.S., including important government buildings like the Pentagon." So again, where were our air defenses? You know, why we had that warning. 11 other countries warned of an imminent and major attack. There were war game exercises that day, which you can read about in the Journal of 9/11 Studies if you look up Joe Firmich's paper. He's a local man, I believe. At least his family's from this area. Okay, moving right along. By contrast, on 9/10, the day before, FEMA had personnel in Manhattan. So let's read about this. This is Tom Kenny to Dan Rather, an interview on the 13th, so 2 days after 9/11. He said, is one of the first responders. "We're currently one of the first teams that was deployed to support the city of New York in this disaster. We arrived on late Monday night, 9/10, and went right into action Tuesday morning, 9/11. Now that is efficiency, folks. That is efficiency. They were there the day before. Now think of, compare that with Katrina, how long it took FEMA to get there. Yeah? And we knew the hurricane was coming, right? It's not like, but here, supposedly, there was no foreknowledge, and yet, they were there in Manhattan, close by, the day before. Giuliani points out in his testimony to the 9/11 Commission that did not make the report, so pay attention, this is important. And the reason Pier 92 was selected as command center was on the next day, on September 12th, Pier 92 was going to have a drill. But they, remember, they came on the 10th, getting ready for this drill planned for the 12th, you see. It had hundreds of people there from FEMA and so on. They were getting ready for a drill for biochemical attacks, so that was going to be the place they were going to have the drill. The equipment was already there on the 11th, and the people. Remarkable. I think we deserve some answers, how they knew about that. Okay, I quoted President Peck. I moved that up. Okay, because again, I want to put that in context, you know, let's bring it back again. A warning that for us, in our generation, there will be these secret combinations, which, by the way, not just mobs, because as Moroni talks about, they seek to take away the freedom of all the countries in the world. This is a big operation. And as outlined by Joel Skousen. Okay, the dust. World Trade Center dust, you've seen it, I'm sure, was actually very toxic and loaded with melted spheres. This gets into some research I've been doing lately. Isaiah said the truth will whisper from the dust. And indeed, that dust does carry a lot of information to it. It was immediately found out by scientists that the dust was extremely alkaline and toxic. With a pH, I'm quoting now Greg Swayze, that some of it was as caustic as liquid drain cleaner. It's not something you want to breathe in or tell people it's safe, right? No. These results were sent to officials at EPA. Then in 2003, there came out a report, quoting now from the Associated Press, the White House convinced EPA to add reassuring statements and delete cautionary ones, according to a report issued by EPA Inspector General Nikki Tinsley. Do you think she kept her job after this? No, she lost her job. At the White House's direction, the Environmental Protection Agency gave New Yorkers misleading assurances that there was no health risk. I'm starting to get a little ticked, you know, come on. We know it's dangerous. In science, that's called data falsification. In everyday life, it's called lying. When you tell people it's safe, when in fact it's like liquid drain cleaner. Come on, these are people. We care for people, don't we? More than corporations and the Wall Street, you know, they told them, go back to work in the financial industry. It's safe, don't worry about it. Well, it's not safe. We can clean it up, but, you know, let's tell the truth. Okay, now, of course, there are thousands who are sick and lawsuits to help care for those who are hurt by this because medical money has been refused these people because they said, well, it was safe, you know, but now, of course, we know it's not safe and so on. Okay, now another topic. Take a deep breath. Wake up. This, you may remember from last year, there were fires in some churches in Alabama. The investigators searched for the use of accelerants, chemicals that would accelerate the fires, get them started, for example. Yeah. So, in fact, according to several news reports, they did find an accelerant called thermite, which proves that there was arson when you find an accelerant like that. Doesn't mean you know who did it yet, but you know there was a crime committed when you find the accelerant. The Guide for Fire and Explosion Investigations, NFPA 921, states, unusual residues might remain from the initial fuel. Those residues could arise from thermite, etc. We're heading on into thermite here, discussion. This is standard. And if we find, which we have, traces of thermite, then we know that a crime was committed and we need a trial. Now, thermite is a highly energetic reaction that involves aluminum powder and iron oxide. On the left, you see a reaction that I did myself. You see the white smoke drifting away. If you get some of my videos that are available online, you'll see this in motion. But the point is there's also the same appearing molten metal pouring out of the South Tower just minutes before its collapse. This is discussed in my most recent paper in the Journal of 9/11Studies.com. I don't have time to go into that in great detail here, but you can look it up there. In recent years, quoting, the use of thermite reactions as incendiary devices has gained popularity with arsonists because they are easily ignited, burn quickly, and can generate a very intense heat in excess of 4,000 Fahrenheit. They produce a characteristic burn pattern and leave behind evidence. These compounds are rather unique in their chemical composition. So here is the chemical signature for thermite. Don't expect you to memorize this, but on the left you see an X-ray energy dispersive spectrograph. That will be on the exam, by the way. So, please take note of that. You see Fe, a peak. Now, when there's a peak, that means this element is present. Fe is? Good, iron. You see Cu, it's fairly small, but that's copper. You see Al. Here, right? And then sulfur. And these are the characteristics of thermite with sulfur added. Sulfur makes the thermite, the hot molten iron, cut through steel faster. So that's what you expect if there's thermite. That's the signature you look for. It's basically iron aluminum. That's the combination. And, you know, a fair amount of aluminum, you know, several percent. Okay, in the dust of the World Trade Center, I have a photo micrograph, which I took through, it's a photo through a microscope, optical, on your right, and Jeanette McKinley, who provided a sample of the World Trade Center dust on the left. She's a survivor. Basically, her apartment was about 100 meters away from the South Tower. When the South Tower collapsed, the windows on her apartment broke in, and her apartment was flooded with dust. And she collected some of that. She said she had a spiritual sense that she should collect some of that dust. And it's a good thing she did. There's a great deal of information coming to us from these spheres that we see in the dust. You see the spheres there optically. When you look under a microscope, they still look like spheres on your right there. And here is the pattern that we observe for this sphere from the dust. Iron, aluminum, sulfur, and some copper. Now you say, well, how did I get so close in the other one? Let's see, let's compare. Here are the two compared. Can you tell which one is the World Trade Center dust and which one is the thermite? They're very close. There are some differences. Now, the reason the thermite is so close, you can tell they're different, though. I'll tell you the key. March 7th is when we, if you're paying attention to the dates, you have to be a good scientist, is when we analyzed the World Trade Center dust sphere and saw this signature. On the right, this was thermite that March 15th, 8 days later. So what I did is designed the thermite trying to match what I saw in the World Trade Center dust, and I did pretty well. I think you'd agree. Not perfectly. Here's the formula I actually used, and I do want to point out that even though you can buy thermite on eBay, it's still dangerous stuff. I wouldn't recommend it. So when you fire this thermite off, you do get tiny spheres. And what happens is the sparks that go into the air, the molten iron and aluminum, there's some captured in there. Because it's molten, the metal is pulled into a spherical shape, and that's because of surface tension. So you get that spherical shape. And we see this in the dust, just thousands, millions of these spheres finally. And in thermite, you also get the spheres as well as flow. And of course, we saw the flow out of the South Tower, that molten metal, which I argue in my paper is also very strong evidence for thermite. An independent laboratory at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts took some both World Trade Center 7 steel and tower steel, and they show what they found when they looked inside. Now, they looked in a region where there was a high-temperature corrosion attack on the steel. They were puzzled by this. And look what they find in there. Sulfur. Large amounts of sulfur. Now, this is not supposed to be in steel because it weakens steel. It also makes it melt at lower temperature. They report the severe corrosion and subsequent erosion of these samples are a very unusual event. These are fire engineering experts, material scientists. No clear explanation for the source of the sulfur has been identified. Well, we think we found it. It's the sulfur added to the thermite. And we're doing experiments to test that and to verify that. We'll leave it at that. We also looked at the World Trade Center concrete. We crushed it and did not see any iron-rich spheres in the concrete. You know, somehow they are released in the process. Cornell University, I sent a sample of this dust to them. Independent analysis, they confirm significant iron and aluminum. That's where the apartment was. USGS and others, the Geological Survey, report the existence of iron-rich spheres in the dust. I called the fellow who was in charge of this project. I said, "Surely you saw those iron-rich spheres. Where in the world do you think they came from?" And he said, "Well, you know, I'm not real sure, but maybe when they were cutting the steel during cleanup, that would produce some spheres, yes. And somehow those got to large distances. I mean, you know, 10, 15 blocks away." In addition, of course, the steel spheres, we did some of that with an oxyacetylene torch as a test. Those spheres do not show high aluminum, nor high sulfur, you know, because that would not be a strong steel if you did that. R.J. Lee report also reports spherical iron particles. So there's abundant evidence. How do you form, just in the face of it, these spheres require extremely high temperatures, around 2800 Fahrenheit to form. What's the temperature you can reach with thermite, typically?
4,000.
Good, you guys are a sharp group. R.J. Lee reports finding, this is something we hadn't noticed in our studies, evaporated lead coating on dust fibers, and they comment the presence of lead oxide on the surface of mineral wool. There's a lot of mineral wool in the buildings. It's used for insulation, among other things. Indicates the existence of extremely high temperatures, over 3,000 Fahrenheit. Folks, you just cannot get anywhere near there with burning office materials. If you did, wood and paper and kerosene. Jet fuel is a form of kerosene. I have a kerosene stove, too. It's steel. It's not going to melt on me, you know. Okay. So you can't get anywhere near it. So how do they explain these high temperatures? Well, they don't. They just report that there's this lead. Well, how do we explain it? Thermite reactions give you those high temperatures. Probably other explosives in the building as well. There's reasons for that statement, but anyway, it's not just thermite I'm talking about here, but we have the evidence for thermite. We feel that we need, therefore, to have, we have basis to demand, really, a criminal investigation and a trial to see who put the thermite in these buildings. Okay, I'm going to go to the next topic now. This is close to the end. Hang on there. Billions estimated made on put options. Now, what's a put option? It's an opportunity in the stock market to make money when a stock goes down. If you think that it's pulling one out of the air, that American Airlines is going to go down in their stock value, then you would buy a put. And if it goes down, you make money. It's betting it'll go down. That's a put option. So quoting from Bloomberg, by the way, which are the two airlines that were involved? American and United. Trading in so-called put options, which rise in value when stock prices fall, surged as much as 285 times the previous average volume in American and United during the days before September 11th. Slightly suspicious again, huh? It's like FEMA being there the day before. I mean, these guys, though, are greedy, greedy. Ooh. Okay, Don Rattelauer says, this is, no similar trading in other airlines occurred on the Chicago Exchange in the days immediately preceding Black Tuesday. Not only do they know that there's something happening, I've looked at the data, by the way, it's just about the five trading days before 9/11, it suddenly goes way up and then back down. And then, of course, they made a lot of money on these puts because, sure enough, United and American went down, way down after the attacks. Jack Manette talks about this in his book. BBC, American authorities are investigating unusually large numbers of shares in these airlines, United and American. Insurance companies also, specifically those which insure the WTC, Munich Re in particular, and ARMS, which is a German company. Detail. Arms manufacturers, those went up, you know, right? The arms stocks went up after 9/11. They believe the sales were, this is not put options, right? On the arms, okay. They believe the sales were by people who knew about the impending disaster, a fairly obvious conclusion. Bloomberg News, this would be the most extraordinary coincidence in the history of mankind if it was a coincidence. This could very well be insider trading at the worst, most horrific, most evil use you've ever seen in your entire life. It's absolutely unprecedented, and we would like to get to the bottom of it, right? Yes.
Andreas van Bülow estimated the worldwide amount for these trades at $15 billion. Okay, 9/11 Commission report does include this. A little hard to escape because it was so obvious and it was in the media so extensively. In a footnote on page 499, we read, highly publicized allegations of insider trading in advance of 9/11 generally rest on reports of unusual pre-9/11 trading activity in companies whose stocks plummeted after the attacks. Right? Some unusual trading did, in fact, occur. Okay, grant that. But each such trade proved to have an innocuous explanation with no conceivable ties to Al-Qaeda. What's the matter? It's not Al-Qaeda. Go away. It's okay. Let them make some money. Now, are you happy with that? Is this blinders on Al-Qaeda only? I mean, look, the Book of Mormon tells us there were terrorists out there in the wilderness, right? But there are also Gadians in the management of the government, right? Okay, so we should be clued in that we're not going to be happy just to say, well, it's not Al-Qaeda, let them make some money. Come on, I want to know the names of these people that made this money and what they knew and how they knew it, and let's get this going. So I just remind you that the scientific method takes all the facts and then you try to draw conclusions from them. Another method, in this cartoon called the political method, you start with the conclusion, Al-Qaeda did it, the Muslims did it, and then you only look at those facts that support your conclusion. Anything else is innocuous, I guess. This question comes up quite often. We're getting really close to the end now. Was my paper peer-reviewed? The paper, and I'll just answer that because that came up just yesterday again. So I'm really concerned about that. The paper this is the paper that came out in November of 2005. You may some of you saw it. It was in Deseret News front page. I was quite surprised they did that, but they did. It said, professor predicts or says bombs, not planes, brought down the towers, something like that. Well, I wouldn't use the term bombs. I would use the term cutter charges, but, you know, okay, that was close enough. The paper was peer-reviewed. I wouldn't have published it without that. And it was accepted for an Elsevier publication in October. And it was put online with the permission of the editor in November. Now, someone noted the editor supported Marxist studies and objected to the venue for my paper. And some still think my paper is published with Professor Ruzremka. It's not. Here's what actually happened. A solution, so this is a bit of a crisis because there's a lot of pressure for me to just pull my paper. Oh, you can't publish with this guy. He's a Marxist. Or at least he teaches Marxism at the University in New York State. Professor David Ray Griffin, who's written a number of books about 9/11, excellent works, in my opinion, he suggested a trade. This is with me and Professor Ruzremka. I would submit my paper to a volume that he and Professor Scott were putting together and editing, and he would replace my paper with one of his own, an essay that he was working on. And that was agreed on, and I thought all parties were satisfied with that agreement. Seems so, and we went that way for months. However, the paper would have to undergo another round of stiff peer reviews, which was the case. And peer reviews, that means other PhDs looking at your paper and critiquing it, roughly stated. That process goes back to the time of Isaac Newton and is very effective in science. These are anonymous peer reviewers in general. If they weren't anonymous, then the peer review process would tend to break down. You say, well, you let Joe Blow read my paper. I know he won't like it. You know, so it has to be anonymous, and that's understood. In general, it's kept that way. But Professor Griffin stated there were four peer reviewers for my paper this second time around, all of them PhDs, and two of them were physicists. And this is where my paper was published, 9/11, An American Empire, Intellectuals Speak Out. Griffin, by the way, was invited by, I can't remember his name. But anyway, he's spoken here at BYU. He's quite a well-known fellow. I can't remember. it's coming, but not there yet. Okay. I want to say something about the publication. There was a tremendous effort to get this paper pulled off the internet, not published, and so on. For example, emails from a contractor who claimed Homeland Security contacts said, the publication of this article can be stopped, and I have the contact necessary, have the contacts to make this happen. This is just days after my paper was online and the Des News article. You need to give this very serious consideration, he wrote to me and others at the university. This is an issue that is more important than any individual career. I believe he was referring to my career. I corresponded with him on some technical points and came out pretty good, as he admitted in the exchange. He said, I have learned to appreciate the value of silence, even in the case of superior data and information. Now this to me a little obvious. He said, as painful, and he wanted me to pull my paper, as painful as it may seem now, perhaps it may be less painful than it could occur after publication. About 2 weeks after publication, then I was put on leave, and I just want to point out there's a lot of pressure. I don't fault the university. They offered me actually a very, fair, I believe, package for early retirement. I was not fired. I was offered early retirement. Now, if you want to read more about these topics, which I can't possibly cover in this short time, please go to this journal. Here's some of the authors in the Journal of 9/11 Studies. Wish I could introduce them to you, but you'll have to go to the journal there yourself to meet these folks. Scholars from all over the world now. Two of those shown here from Canada, for example. We are submitting papers now to what's called Tier 1, Tier 2 journals. My first paper called for an investigation. It's not something you would expect to find in Scientific American. But now we have research data, and so I and others are submitting research results to these publications. I just show you, I published in Nature, Carol went through these, and Physical Review Letters published in Scientific American. With Professor Rafelski, published in Nature. These results were confirmed. Cold fusion. Wish I had time to tell you about that. That's my other life, And solar cooking is my other life. Okay. Conclusions. Yes, I'm going to skip that because I want to talk about what we can do instead. The conclusions, we already been through that. Freshen your mind. There is this international 9/11 truth movement. It is growing, as you can see from the group assembled here. And we can hand out literature. I point to Jack Manette's book, The Journal of 9/11 Studies, online, and so on. Please take courage. As Elder Packer pointed out, this is a time where we need inspiration, and as we have that, we can, together, we can make it through. And courage is, and love, you see, are the watchwords. Who said this? The Book of Mormon narrative is a chronicle of nations long since gone, but in its descriptions of the problems of today's society, it is as current as the morning newspaper. President Hinckley. Now, it talks about secret combinations over and over in this book, You can't miss it. You can if you really try. But, okay. President McKay said, we commend and encourage every person and group who is sincerely seeking to study constitutional principles and awaken a sleeping and apathetic people to the alarming conditions that are rapidly advancing about us. Rally around the Constitution, one of my favorite themes. North American Union, if you don't know about that, Google on it. What can we do? The rotating 3-month food supply. One, this one, second one. That's in the new church pamphlet where you have 3-month supply and you're actually using that and replenishing it. So you always have a 3-month supply. I think that's a great idea. I think a lot of people aren't seeing it, but you get the pamphlet. It's right there. Along with the year supply. Solar cookers, fitness. I was glad Joel mentioned that. I I'll take note of that, Joel. I'm working on that tomorrow. Gardens, resourcefulness, faith, and love. This picture of me with the solar cooker, that would be me on your right there. I've given out hundreds of these to people all over the world in developing countries, these solar cookers. And it's a good thing for us to have a way to cook, you see, if the electricity should go out, for example. The end is getting closer, and this is a little Einstein here. But I'll finish with Joseph Smith. It is an imperative duty we owe to all the rising generation. Therefore, we should waste and wear out our lives in bringing to light all the hidden things of darkness. Thank you.
Stephen Jones, sure appreciate all the work and the courage that these brethren have, and for the messages that they give to us. Our next speaker, Jack Monette, is the author of Revealed Educational Principles in Public Schools, one of my favorite homeschool books, John Taylor, Educator, An Awakening to Our Awful Situation. He's worked for the church educational system for 30 years, full and part-time. He's been in the state presidency, he's been a bishop, and he's been the state right to life president. And here we are for Jack Monette.
Hey, all of you get up for about 2 minutes and just stretch. Okay, break's over. Too, and it's always a pleasure to be with these men. I learn from them every time I listen. I thought I'd memorize Steve's talk by now, but I really haven't. He's got new things every time, so somebody pay attention to. You know, we are talking, Dr. Jones has been talking about Twin Towers. You've had Joel Skousen talking about basically the world situation, and this tonight was the most lucid I've heard Brother Skousen talk about just where this is all going. It was a real education. But you know, as we've talked about these various things, there is a picture here. And that is where you and I, as members, and I'm not sure I'm talking to all Latter-day Saints here, but I'm going to pretend like you are, and don't let me offend anybody. But we seem to have an inside. We seem to have a knowledge, perhaps, that other people don't have. I can recall let me share something with you. A few months ago, a man named Chris Bolin, had written a little bit about Steve and had come down to his office at BYU, and he had asked Brother Jones, he said, how is it you can be so definite, so dynamic about what you believe? And Dr. Jones said, well, here's a copy of the Book of Mormon. Here's what I believe. And of course, he had it marked and all the burden paragraphs. And Steve then wrote back, or not Steve, but Christopher Bolin wrote back, and he said, wow. He said, if this is true, then you have something no one else has. I wish I had that letter here to read to you, because it's remarkable. And he said that that makes your church the most powerful church on the planet. That was the way he phrased it. Because you've got an inside edge on this. What's our inside edge? We have the Book of Mormon. And you've heard a lot of allusions to that today, and a lot of different definite references to the Book of Mormon, and that's really where I'm coming from, and where that book is coming from, the awakening to our awful situation. I might just say in passing here also, I don't know how many of you subscribe to World Affairs Brief. I found that to be one of the best sources I have of inside information. Not necessarily inside information, but it's information that I don't get through the Fox News channel, or even on Channel 5. And that's what Joel authors, and you receive that every 2 weeks, isn't it, Joel?
Every week.
Every week. Okay. I need to catch up my reading. Anyway, you might be able to subscribe to that over the web. I encourage you to. It's really good reading. Well, in all of that, what are we talking about? You know, if I can just go back a little bit and just refresh you with the Sunday school class. And most of you are aware of these things anyway, but I think they're definitely worth talking about. It is... Joel, can I have my glasses over there? Can't see anything without them. Thank you. I guess what we're going to talk about today is the twofold mission of the church. You thought it was threefold, didn't you? The twofold mission of the church. That's to afflict, or to what, comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. And I suspect we're talking about the second part of that, to afflict the comfortable. Because in the church, we seem to have kind of fallen asleep at the switch for much of this. And yet you recall in the year 2005, Gordon B. Hinckley, President Hinckley said, read the Book of Mormon. There's a challenge given to all members of the church. And we found, at least in my travels, I found people were reading the Book of Mormon. It's the first time in my life that I can remember the members of the church all being pretty much on the same page about the Book of Mormon. It was exciting. And we came to the end of that year, and there are a number of books that were written on the Book of Mormon, and I kept waiting for a certain book to be written, and it wasn't. I was waiting for the warnings coming from the Book of Mormon, and nobody wrote that. There were some wonderful doctrinal things, but finally I turned to my wife about Christmas of 2005, and I said, dear, it looks like nobody's going to write the book. What if I did? And she laughed. And I began writing just that Christmas season in 2005 about the warnings of the Nephite prophets. You recall in the Book of Mormon, the whole book is important, but there are two particular prophets who write to us in our generation today. Remember them? Mormon and Moroni. They're the ones all throughout the Book of Mormon who are making asides to the latter-day readers of the Book of Mormon. All the other prophets are very important. Don't neglect any of them. But look specifically for Mormon and Moroni, because as they go through and they make commentaries along the way, they say, and by the way, you readers in the latter days. And then they have something for us to look at. Well, in that, I think probably there are several places that we could quote, but I always go to Ether chapter 8. And many of you are very familiar with that scripture, because you have in here Moroni, a prophet who's looking at 24 gold plates. And as he does that, he begins to see that there are so many similarities among the Jaredite civilization compared to the Nephite civilization. And he said he saw our day, and Mormon particularly says that, they saw later, right now, what was happening. And he said, and those things are going to happen to you also. And so there in Ether chapter 8, let me just read a little bit of it to you and try not to be too laborious with it. But you recall the situation there. There is Achish, and you were looking at Jared here initially. Jared, not the same Jared that was the founder of the Jaredites, but Jared, who is a later king, and his daughter comes to him. And she said, Dad, there's a way that we can consolidate this whole kingdom here and make sure that we don't have any problems in the future, and that is to resurrect all the oaths and covenants of the old world, the old time before we came over here. Don't you remember those things are written down in the records? And he says, yes, I do remember. And then she said, well, tell you what, I'm going to get a fellow named Achish, and I'll do a dance for him. Sounds like Salome, doesn't it? I'm going to do a dance for him, and we will convert him, and then we'll be able to use him to again instigate the oaths and the covenants from the olden times and bring them over here. And so, in doing that, you have Achish that becomes a leader at that time of this Gadianton band. They don't call them Gadiantons at that time because Gadianton personally hasn't been around, but the oaths and covenants of Satan. It came to pass that they all swear unto him by the God of heaven. I'm reading now from verse 14 of Ether 8. And also by the heavens and also by the earth in their hands, and whoso should vary from the assistance which Achish desired should lose his head. What kind of an oath were they taking? It was a blood oath, wasn't it? In other words, you veer from this in any direction, you lose your life. You better listen. And whoso should divulge whatsoever thing Achish made known unto them, the same should lose his life. Well, everybody goes along with Achish, and they begin this secret band. And then Moroni talks about that band and what they do and how it pertains to you and I today. He said, number one, these weren't just some bright men who got together and came up with an idea, but instead, they were kept up by the power of the devil to administer these oaths unto the people, to keep them in darkness, to help such as sought power to gain power, and to murder and to plunder. Murder! It's pretty serious, isn't it? And yet you remember the oath that Cain made when Cain made that pact with Satan, and he left that oath and he said, I am Master Mahan. You remember that? I know the great secret. I can murder and get gain. That was what it was all about. Boy, it's a good thing that was then and not now, isn't it? And he continues, and to lie and to commit all manner of wickedness and whoredoms. And then Moroni began to talk about this a little bit, and he said, they formed a secret combination, even as they did of old, which combination is most abominable and wicked above all in the sight of God. Secret combinations, that's a Mormonism, isn't it? Does anybody ever use that term besides us? I think we know what it means, but secret combination, you know, it's interesting. If you go back to the 1828 Webster's Dictionary, and you look at the word combination, you know what the other word is right next to that? Conspiracy. Isn't that something? We don't talk about that today, do we? In fact, when you say conspiracy, what happens? Generally, people look down at their shoes, they look up at the ceiling. We don't get a good dialogue when we mention the word conspiracy. I have a good friend, and he said that he frequently will talk about conspiracy, but he said that he's learned that he better not use the word conspiracy. Instead, he says things like, events were orchestrated in such a way, and you think about that, that's the same thing, isn't it? We just don't like to use the word conspiracy. Well, conspiracy is really what it is. Remember Ezra Taft Benson? President Benson made a statement one time. He said, there is no conspiracy theory in the Book of Mormon. Isn't it interesting? We always use the word theory with conspiracy. We seem to think the two are synonymous. What's a theory? Totally unproven. Conspiracy theory. He says there is none in the Book of Mormon. It's a conspiracy fact. There's no way around it. Well, then, continuing here, back to Moroni again. The Lord worketh not in secret combinations. Neither will he that man should shed blood, but in all things hath forbidden it. And now I, Moroni, do not write the manner of their oaths and combinations, because it hath been made known unto me that they are had among all people, and they are had among the Lamanites, they were had among the Jaredites, and what about us? They are had among all people. Frightening. And they have caused the destruction of this people of whom I am now speaking, and also the destruction of the people of Nephi. The Jaredites were wiped out because of secret combinations. The Nephites, we often think the Lamanites did it, don't we? But the Lamanites were simply spurred on, and the Nephites, by their wickedness, brought on all the results of, again, the warfare that took place. But it was the secret combinations that brought them down. And whatsoever nation shall uphold such secret combinations to get power and gain until they shall spread over the nation, behold, they shall be destroyed. Could he be talking about us? He continues, and this was alluded to, quoted by Dr. Jones here. Wherefore, O ye Gentiles, it is wisdom in God that these things should be shown unto you, that thereby ye may repent of your sins and suffer not that these murderous combinations shall get above you. We'd never do that, would we? Would we ever allow anybody to get above us like that, to make decisions for us? You know, freedom seems to be the key here. Would we ever allow our sovereignty to be taken, our freedoms to be taken? No, we wouldn't do that, would we? And if we wouldn't, then perhaps that doesn't even pertain to us. But somehow he seems to feel it does, because he continues this way. And he says, the work of destruction will come upon you. Yea, even the sword of justice of the eternal God shall fall upon you to your overthrow and destruction, if ye shall suffer these things to be. It cometh to pass that whoso buildeth up and seeketh to overthrow the freedom of all lands, nations, and countries, that secret combination would be the culprit there. Well, anyway, there are a number of things that you and I can look at in the Book of Mormon, and we say these things are true. How many here are teachers? You know, we're in Utah County, we just assume that half the people here are teachers. And so, speaking of teachers, what's the best way to teach? You know, when I used to teach my classes, I'd give lectures, and then if there's something I really wanted to know, I'd repeat. And if I really wanted to know it, I'd repeat it again. And I wonder sometimes if Moroni isn't using some of our BYU teaching techniques. You get into Ether Chapter 2. All of Ether, the whole Book of Mormon is wonderful, but you know, Ether 2. Tell me if you can mistake this in any way. He said, and he's talking about the Promised Land. In Ether Chapter 1, Chapter 2, Chapter 2 specifically, he's talking about coming here to a very special place preserved for people not only at that day and age, but now. And he said, he hath sworn in his wrath unto the brother of Jared that whoso should possess this land, this is God, swearing his wrath to the brother of Jared, that from time henceforth and forever they should serve him, the true and only God, or they should be swept off when the fullness of his wrath should come upon them. Now, we just talked about how that would take place there over in Ether Chapter 8. But you notice the verbiage here? Or they should be swept off when the fullness of his wrath should come upon them. I'm going to read the next verse, see if we can't see some redundancy here. And now we can behold the decrees of God concerning this land. It's a land of promise. And whatsoever nation shall possess it shall serve God, or they shall be swept off when the fullness of his wrath shall come upon them. And the fullness of his wrath cometh upon them when they are ripened in iniquity. Next verse. And behold, this is a land which is choice above all other lands. Wherefore, he that doth possess it shall serve God, or shall be, guess what he's going to say? Swept off. For it is the everlasting decree of God, and it is not until the fullness of iniquity among the children of the land that they are swept off. You getting the point there? I can't think of any more visual thing to say than swept off. That's, you think about that. What's swept off? We're gone, aren't we? Or those who are, the Lord's talking about here, are simply gone. They're swept off. That's pretty powerful. Well, a number of things there in the Book of Mormon itself. How do we uphold these secret combinations? And I guess there are a myriad of ways that you and I could do that unknowingly. I don't think anybody would ever wittingly say, I want this secret combination, that conspiracy, I want it to get above me. Nobody would do that. In fact, we're here. In a couple of days, we're going to celebrate a Freedom Festival again. This is known nationwide as the Freedom Festival, isn't it? I mean, who loves freedom more than we do here? And yet, I wonder if we could, in our love for freedom, somehow be looking the wrong way and perhaps looking at some of the wrong things of what freedom really is. As I look at freedom and what's going on here, let's go back. Let me just give you a quick historical example. And many of you, some of you have read my book, and we get into this also, but just think for a minute. I'm going back now about 90 years. And 90 years ago, there was a time when America was fairly happy with what they had. They had a monetary system that was basically government-sponsored. They had a system at that time that they had a president, and the president was William Howard Taft, a very popular president, a good president. They were out of war. They had done things pretty right. All of a sudden, things changed. A historian looks at the history books and he says, well, why did everything take place against what people wanted at that time? How could possibly the world, the United States, have shifted to such a great degree? Go back in your history books and look. Woodrow Wilson became the next president. Who was Woodrow Wilson? And if you were alive at that time, you would have said, I never heard of the guy. Who is he? He had been president of Princeton University. He had been half a term governor of the state of New Jersey, but nobody knew who he was. He was going to run against William Howard Taft. How in the world could you get people to vote for him? Maybe you can split the vote. We have to find somebody else equally popular. Who would that be? Teddy Roosevelt. He doesn't get his nomination from his party, so we'll have a new party. We'll call it the Bull Moose Party. Look at that. Very interesting the way the vote was split. And a man who people didn't know became president, and you know what? It wasn't even him who was president. It was his alter ego, a man named Colonel House. Colonel House wasn't a colonel any more than Colonel Sanders was a colonel. But it was an honorary title given to him. And just as Hitler had written the book called Mein Kampf, saying, here's what I would do if I were in power, Colonel Mandel House had also written a book called Philip Drew Administrator. Here's what I would do were I in power. Primary there, we would take both parties and we would control both parties so people would always vote for the person that we wanted in office. Does that sound familiar? Yeah. Way back then. So Woodrow Wilson became president. You know, people didn't want the war either. But the war happened. You have everyone against the war, and yet somehow, when it happens, people assume that's the right thing to do. You heard of PR work? We call them spin doctors today. And at that time, all of a sudden, because all the newspapers, which is the source of information, were controlled by one group. And so all of the information that came out to the people said, we have to get in a war with Germany because these are despised people. They're horrible. They hate children. They throw children down. They step on them. They swear. They do all kinds of nasty things. Go beat them. And we did. We got involved in a war because of a spin doctor, and I won't go into that in any detail here. Income tax, who in the world would vote for income tax? And yet that same time period we did. Why? Because it was a soak the rich scheme, they said. And yet they didn't bother to say, by the way, the very wealthy would not have to pay income tax because we're going to form foundations and so forth. A number of things that go on here. All of a sudden, things shift. That's one way to look at history. Do they let the secret combination get above them? I wonder if we do that today. And we look at the very same tactics in use today. We need to be very aware and very concerned about that. Well, I'm not going to go on to like Dr. Jones here. I've run out of time too. But there are a number of things that you and I need to look at. And the fact is that these things aren't just happenstance. You know, I suspect you and I knew before we came to this earth that we would be coming to earth at a very troubled time. And yet, you know, I can just imagine going back, being on the other side, and having someone say, hey, you were alive during those Twin Towers. Tell me about that. That must have really been something. You must have really been there when you woke up to what was going on. That must have really been a revelation to you. And I could just see some dialogue going on there. I don't know. But I do know that you and I knew and we covenanted when we came here that we would be going through troubled times. The Lord knew these things. You read Matthew chapter 23, or Joseph Smith, Matthew, and you get into all that. It's all laid out for us, isn't it? It says all these things are going to occur, but the same thing goes on. Every other verse, the Lord makes a statement. See that ye be not troubled. This isn't gloom and doom. We aren't talking about the end of the world, woe is me. What we're saying is you and I have a very special mission at this point, and that is to help people awake to an awful situation. That's part of the plan. I'll just end on this note. A person came to me. He had read this book that I wrote here. He just saw my name on it. He was at a bookstore. He said, oh, I know the author. I think I'll buy the book. He was in our ward. And he read it. Great man. Been on 5 different missions for the church. Just a tremendous individual. And when he came to me, he came in a Sunday, and he had the book in his hand, and he was quivering, and a very choked voice. And he said, Brother Monette, I believe it. Now, what do I need to do? Have you ever asked yourself that question? I believe it. Now, what do I need to do? What can I do? And I didn't know what to tell him. And I made it a matter of prayer, and I'll just share this with you. And I basically said, Lord, there are people asking, what do I do? I don't know what to tell them. And it came very loud and clear and strong to me. The title of this book is Awakening to Our Awful Situation, The Warnings from the Nephite Prophets. This isn't a what-to-do book. This is a wake-up call. And that's all we're talking about. Once a person has knowledge, the Lord can work with that person. You can work with others who have knowledge. If a person has no knowledge of what's going on, can the Lord work with him? Probably not. There's a vacuum there. Once knowing that, then we can literally awake and arise, as Barbara Jean likes to say, to our awful situation. Let me leave on pretty much the same basis that Dr. Jones did, except that I'm going to read that entire scripture because I like it so well. 3 verses from section 123 of the Doctrine and Covenants. This pertains to everyone here because all of us know and work with people who are in the same situation of not really being awake. And maybe I'm talking to some of you here that are saying, wow, what a bunch of steam. I hope not, but there may be many here in that situation. There are many yet on the earth among all sects, parties, and denominations who are blinded by the subtle craftiness of men. They're blinded by Fox News, whatever. The subtle craftiness of men. We live in a day when, as Joel said, we are a very believing people. We like to believe the best. And because of that, sometimes, to our detriment, we allow people to get by, get on with the things that are very detrimental. Whereby they lie in wait to deceive and are kept only from the truth because they know not where to find it. Therefore, that we should waste and wear out our lives and bring into light all the hidden things of darkness wherein we know them. They are truly manifest from heaven. And I could read that over and over again. They are truly manifest from heaven. If you want to know, if I want to know, if we're on the right track to learning what's going on, we will receive that in section 8 of the Doctrine and Covenants, the Spirit of Revelation. We will know both in our heads, it'll make sense to us. We'll know in our hearts, it'll feel right to us. We'll know these things are true. And I personally, as you can tell, I know they are. These should be attended to with great earnestness. That's where you and I are today. In great earnestness, we have a knowledge. It's up to you and I to share that with others, to help others understand the same thing. This has been a wonderful experience that we have had, my wife and I, in doing the research on this, getting involved with this, working with these brethren here, because all of us are committed to sharing that knowledge with the world. Thank you.
We'll have questions coming right out here. But Carol's moderating, so I just want to let you know we do have time for questions.
If you'll pass any questions you have to the outside of the rows, and Leslie and Becky Jones will come to the sides and pick up your questions for you. Also, I want to remind you that the DVDs that you can purchase, you can get if you go email Tim Costello at yahoo.com. He's going out of town for a week, but he will probably have them about a week or about 2 weeks, he said. Got my first question here. This question is for Joel. It says, what steps would you take to oppose the New World Order globalists?
Boy, where do you begin with a question like, how do you start to oppose the globalists? First of all, I want to emphasize that this is much bigger than even people like myself know about. I mean, when we hear the secret acts of men that will be revealed upon the housetop at the second coming, I can tell you it won't be about the mafia. And it won't be about the Taliban or any of the other little groups around. It will be about the Anglo-American establishment, that which we call the globalists, people who masqueraded as the truth. So while I harbor no optimism about being able to beat them in the traditional sense, they hold all the levers of power. They don't control all of you yet, but they hold all the levels of power and they control the media, at least the portion of the media that you listen to. So you're not going to overturn that. And by the way, they got that way through free market principles. They didn't do it by force. They bought out the media. They got themselves elected. They did it by lying. And you believed them. If you voted for George Bush, you believed them. Now, how can you stop that? How can you oppose them? Number one, don't ever vote for the lesser of two evils again. Yay! I'll tell you, they want to give you Rudolph Giuliani as the Republican president. And I know you don't want to vote for him, but they're going to give you Hillary as the alternative. And there's going to be a lot of Republicans that say, I'm going to vote for Rudy, even though I don't like his position on abortion, and I don't like his position on gays, and I don't like the fact that he's a cross-dresser, but he's the lesser of two evils. Well, he isn't the lesser of two evils. Now, they have alternate plans as well. If they can't get Rudy the election, they've got the backup in John McCain. Both of these people are knowing insiders who have betrayed their own principles and this government on numerous occasions. John McCain is not, I repeat, is not a hero of the Vietnam War, neither a hero of the POWs. He collaborated with the POWs. He was hated by his fellow POWs because they knew he collaborated. He cheated on his wives multiple times, and he has betrayed his conservative credentials by claiming to author an anti-torture bill in Congress, and then he, of course, commiserated with the president to, in fact, allow fine print later on that gave it all away at the end. That's the kind of person John McCain is. But he was not a knowing conspirator in 9/11 like Rudolph Giuliani was. Now, what about Mitt Romney? Now, I'll tell you something about Mitt Romney. He's a very fine person. He's a very intelligent person. He's a very sincere person. But I could say that about other people who have been elected to public office as well. But Mitt Romney wants too badly to get elected. And because he falls into the trap of thinking that he's going to do God, his church, and his state and country a service by getting elected, he'll do anything, compromise almost anything, to get elected, just like he did to get elected to governor of Massachusetts. And so that's why the powers that be give him good press, because he's a backup. He's not an insider. He's not a knowing conspirator with them, but he can be used just like Ronald Reagan was used. Ronald Reagan has good conservative credentials, But they used him. And when he protested, they threw an assassination attempt to teach him a lesson. This is what can happen if you buck the system, Ronald. Now, they know how to control people like Mitt Romney. He will do more damage to the conservative movement because he is sincere. And that's why I fear their use of a person who has credentials, who isn't a skull and bones person. Now, I don't think they want him in there. He's a little dangerous because he does have principles, because he may perceive that he's being used. He could rebel, and they might have to eliminate him. They don't want to take that chance. So, above all, they're going to make sure that you don't get someone like Ron Paul to be president.
You want Ron Paul.
Of course you want Ron Paul. I want Ron Paul. Ron Paul is the only principled candidate running for election who is absolutely trusted. Have you ever asked yourself the question, why is it that they will never allow Ron Paul to even get to be a candidate, legitimately, to run, when in fact they will sell you on a newly converted candidate who claims to be constitutional conservative, who claims to be conservative, i.e. George Bush, and they'll sell that to you? Well, that's what we call too good to be true. Never vote for a too good to be true solution. Whether it's an investment or a candidate, it's not true. Ron Paul is not a pretty boy. Ron Paul is straight talking. He's 70 plus years old. This is his last stand in politics. He's going to give it all he's got. And believe me, every one of you people ought to vote for Ron Paul, even if Hillary gets elected, because you need to send a message to the establishment. We're not voting for the lesser of two evils anymore.
Next question is for Stephen Jones. What government pressure has the 911 researchers received? That's part one. And number two, has there been any progress, or who set the explosives?
Well, let's see. Part one, the pressure, certainly. I quoted you some that I had from this fellow who no doubt had Homeland Security contacts. I mean, he gave me some names later as he was going on. Nikki Tinsley, who raised the flag pointing out that the White House had falsified the reports, telling people the dust was safe when it was not safe. Well, that was her job at the EPA. She was the inspector general. That was her position. She lost her job after reporting the perfidy of the White House there. I can think of others. My friend Kevin Ryan lost his job at Underwriters Laboratories when he reported that the tests done by NIST actually showed that actual fire endurance tests, the assemblies of the world, actually built floor assemblies designed on the pattern of the World Trade Center, they did not fail when they put these fires on them. Didn't fail. He reported that publicly, got out publicly, and he was fired. I can think about Rosie O'Donnell comes to mind. She recently lost her job when she started talking about 9/11 also. That's another issue. Carol, now my memory is trying to... Oh, yes, who set the explosives? Well, that, you see, again, when you find traces of thermite or some other cutter charge, you say, well, we know there was a crime. We need now a criminal investigation. We need subpoenas to get people in testifying. I want that young man who was begging the vice president, please, are these orders really going to still stand? I want to know what he knew, you know, and why he was so concerned. But anyway, you have this subpoena power with this investigation. That's what we need. There's some hints out there in this vast community, the 9/11 truth community now, international, as to who was responsible. But you know, look, you've got the principals that give the orders, and then you have guys just following orders. For instance, on 9/11, you had FAA people who were saying, look, we got to scramble jets and so on. They were suppressed, and there are written reports explaining how this was suppressed. Anyway, basically people are just doing their jobs. They're not complicit exactly, right? They're just doing their job. They don't know what's going on. It's the people on top who are pulling the strings. They're the ones that we need to expose.
Question is, to all three men, have you received warnings from the dark side about your activities? If so, how did you handle it?
Well, again, I quoted from that fellow. I did not accept his threats. I mean, he wanted me to pull my paper. No, I didn't. Although I did change publication. That was okay. I mean, it still got out there, maybe even more so, as I had explained that I did. By the way, that same fellow later, when I wouldn't yield to his threats to pull my paper, then he offered bribes. And the way he did that was on three different occasions. He suggested that I would be able to get a large grant of money from the Homeland Security. And he even gave me ideas that I could propose. And this is what you propose, and you will get this large grant. It was very clear, you know, what I had to do to get this bribe money. I mean, I could be a rich guy today, you know, instead of where I am. But I did not do that. And so, you know, that pressure was there, but obviously I turned it up. You have to stand up. I've decided, like David and Goliath, you have to draw a line. You have to stand up to bullies, finally. And the same way with Jesus, when he said, "Woe unto you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, whited sepulchres." What a metaphor, you know. Looking good on the outside, but full of dead man's bones, he said. Publicly, he said that. Criticizing the leaders of his nation because they were evil, right? They were doing evil and hurting people. And he loved people, and so he spoke out against those guys. And Jesus is my example.
I've had no direct threats to myself, but I have had on several occasions, as the publisher of the World Affairs Brief, I get telephone calls from people claiming to be ex-government or dis-governmental people that have classified material that they want to give me. It's a setup, basically, to try to get you to accept classified material, and then they sting you, and then they arrest you for being in possession of things like that. So I've always been able to, at least so far, detect when that's coming happen. So there is an attempt to get you to perform an arrestable offense, which we have to be careful of.
You know, we go to lectures like this. Steve and I are often asked, "Have you got your bulletproof vest on?" And we don't. And I'm not sure that really has become an issue church-wide or church-wise. I will say this. I have met a number of Latter-day Saints who are very angry with things that we've said because they seem to feel those things are in contradiction to what we're hearing from the brethren. Not necessarily so, but again, as you heard that talk that Brother Jones quoted from Boyd K. Packer about mockery from within the church, we do get a lot of that. And that's just one of those things that, you know, I look back at in the Book of Mormon. How often was Alma mocked? And all the other brethren. So something to think about there. It's not necessarily bad if somebody says something that you don't or they don't like what you say and such. But as far as threats, personally, there have been none for me.
What recent books, this is for Joel Scouts, and what recent books or pamphlets help us prepare for the coming hard times?
Well, there's too many to list, and unfortunately I rely on lists myself to do this. I have to recommend strongly, if any of you haven't read Jack's book, Awakening to Our Awful Situation, this is a must-read book for you. It's also important, there's several books on the 9/11. Let me put it this way. One of the problems with preparedness is fairly easy. There's a lot in there. But one of the problems in getting literature out to people to explain the specifics of our situation, my problem in recommending books is, for example, in the 9/11 field, I can't recommend anyone that I don't have significant problems with bad conclusions that they've drawn from correct facts. And that's because we don't have all the information. And so it's easy to draw incorrect conclusions, especially about the Pentagon crash. That's one of the most convoluted, most difficult to analyze positions. It makes the World Trade Center problem look easy when you go through the multiple jets that were seen, the explosives, the missile evidence, the cordite explosives, the radar track, and now the new pilots for 9/11 and their new evidence. They've got the black box data from supposedly from Flight 77, and it shows it never went below an altitude of 100 feet. And yet there are light poles that have been collapsed, you know, from the lowness of the thing. So there's an awful lot of things that are happening there. In terms of preparedness, I myself have written extensively on that. I spent 30 years as a high security architect, mostly trying to share with other people the preparedness that I've done. I have a book called The Secure Home, 700-page monster about everything from A to Z on self-sufficiency and high security and remodeling or new construction. I also have written Strategic Relocation, North American Guide to Safe Places, where I talk about how to design a place to find security amid outside of high-density population areas. And even though Utah is very highly rated in that book, these particular valleys are not very highly rated anymore. You have to actually provide ways to get outside of masses of people. If you can imagine when there is any major crisis and you have everybody, even farmers in Utah, go to the store now. They hardly ever grow a garden. You're going to have a tremendous amount of competition for scarce resources. Alan South here has written an excellent book. Tell me again the name of your book, Alan. Census of Survival, Alan South, an excellent book on preparedness. Jim Phillips has the premier understanding of cold weather clothing, which is essential to be able, if you lose heat, to be able to survive those things. They're made out of readily available materials. There's an awful lot that I and other people have written about, and Alan has written about how to prepare for such things as an earthquake in here. You know, if an earthquake happens in Utah, in the wintertime, you're going to lose your windows in your house. Doesn't matter if you still have gas, which you probably won't have. You're going to need a ready supply of plastic, and if you think you can get down to Home Depot before everybody else does, you're kidding yourself. So you need to stockpile some of these things other than simply bore setting on food storage, as important as that is. And by the way, I'm not a big recommender of expensive freeze-dried. I really think you ought to spend your money on the bulk stuff that will survive without rotating. And that doesn't mean I'm denigrating the importance of having 3 months rotation. That provides the taste and important health and comfort things. But get a ton of wheat, rice, and beans. You're going to live off that, and you don't have to rotate it. Do you see what I mean? And it's cheap. For $1,000, you can buy a little box of freeze-dried stuff, or you can buy a ton of weeds, or plus rice and beans. So use your money wisely in those things, and I think that will go a long way. Thank you.
Joel, you said communism is not dead, it just went underground. When Reagan said, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall," was he knowingly involved in the deception?
I do not believe Ronald Reagan was involved in any way, shape, or form with the conspiracy. He did have to bite his tongue and acquiesce to things that he didn't like. He agreed, for example, he did know some things about the conspiracy that he never revealed. He did know, for example, that he was pressured the day after he got the nomination at the Republican convention when the three heads of the media met with him and they said to him, "Mr. Reagan, we can make or break your candidacy by how we treat you in the media." we would look favorably upon your candidacy only on two conditions. If you would accept someone like George Bush to be your vice president, and if you would let so-and-so, I don't have the name, control your personnel of who is hired in the White House. And he agreed to those two conditions. And so he was not a knowing conspirator in that. Tell me again the question. I've left out a portion.
You said communists cannot get an underground. When Reagan said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, was he knowingly involved in such?
No, but you see, he had scriptwriters who wrote those speeches for him, and they were globalists. So you see, they knew what was coming up, and I think they prepped. You see, they suckered the conservative movement into thinking that their hero, Ronald Reagan, won the Cold War. And it really wasn't true at all. We didn't win the Cold War. The Soviets went underground. And our own media was complicit. They, you know, I'm not a genius. If I can see that this was as phony, a fall of the Soviet Union, I mean, look at the facts. Yeltsin sitting there in front of that tank, broadcasting to the nation, and who's running this? The television station, the Communist Party. Why didn't they pull the plug? Are they that stupid they didn't pull the plug? Eric Honecker in Germany said, I got a call from Moscow, and they ordered me to allow Leipzig, the budding university town, to start to create riots, pro-university riots. And so the normal SPD, the secret police, would have arrested any students who would have tried to start it, and all of a sudden they got the word, you're free to go ahead and have a demonstration. And this was totally scripted from beginning in. Ceausescu of Romania resisted. Moscow told him to step down, and he refused, and they shot him and his wife. This was a complete crafted deception. Now, I don't believe Ronald Reagan had anything to do with it, but his scriptwriters did. And they played the conservatives knowing that they would willingly believe this deception greater if one of their heroes was viewed as the hero of this time.
The next question is not addressed to anyone, so whoever wants to answer it can. Is there going to be an economic collapse? Is acquiring some gold and silver a wise idea?
According to the economic fundamentals, there should be a collapse, especially in the housing market, which is about 30% of the U.S. economy. This thing should be on its back right now. But this whole housing bubble was created, in fact, by federal unleashing of credit, lines of credit to all of these. You know how it used to work with banks, whereby you'd go into a bank, how many of you old-timers remember, you go into a bank for a house loan, and they say, we don't have any loan money available now until somebody else pays off their loan. That's the way it used to work. A bank could only loan up to a certain amount unless they got new capital deposits in. Did anyone in the past 15 years ever get turned down from bank for that reason, that we don't have enough money to loan? Not one of you can say that, because literally every bank and savings and loan had an open funnel to the Federal Reserve. They could get any money amount that they wanted as long as they turned around and could pay the interest. They paid a 2% bank loan charge to them. But that's how this housing bubble was created, and it's collapsing now. But that's why M3, for example, and what I'm putting the case for is that the government is manipulating the economic measurements. They're keeping inflation artificially low by manipulating the CPI and the PPI, which is the producer price index. They've removed M3, the most accurate money supply figure. It has now been recreated by two online websites, and it's running 12 to 13%. Now, they're telling you inflation's running 3.5%, but don't believe them. They don't factor in fuel, they don't factor in housing, any of those other things. If it gets high, they take it out of the basket. So we've got inflation running 12 to 13%, and that's what's keeping this housing alive. Until I see the plunge protection team, which is this combination of government regulators and major Wall Street brokerage and investment houses like Goldman Sachs and Citibank and others meet together to manipulate the futures markets and the options in order to stop a plunge in the stock market Or right now they're dealing with Bear Stearns, is just about ready to go bankrupt. They're large into these subprime loans. This is a major investment banking house. This is like mortgage capital all over again. And they're funneling tons of money into us, which makes me believe that the powers that be, and this is an answer to the question, do not intend to have a major economic depression prior to this Third World War as they did in the Second World War. It's the Federal Reserve that pulled the depression, because that's how they got America to accept socialism. It was a crafted plan to get America to be poor, resentful of the wealthy, and to cry out for socialist benefits. So I don't believe they're going to do that this time, because I believe they want Americans fat, dumb, and happy right up until the time we suffer a preemptive nuclear strike. They don't want anybody to feel aware or warned. And that's why FEMA, with all the so-called terrorist information that they have, is not warning the American people to prepare individually. They want you to depend on FEMA, and you know where that can lead. They do not want you to have individual fallout shelters, and that's why I've said time and again in my newsletter, I do not believe we'll have a dirty bomb, a nuclear bomb set off by a terrorist. Why? Because it will make the American people say, we'd better prepare against nuclear fallout. And they don't want you to prepare. I can tell you that they don't want you to prepare. They want you to be vulnerable to this attack so that you'll be flat on your back, because they know in a condition of abject defeat, you will cry out to your leaders when they come out of their well-prepared bunkers, do anything to save us. Even if that means taking us into a new world order to the United States, oh yes, do anything to save us. We will cry out for deliverance, and that's where they want you. So, that's how I think it's going to come.
Sorry that we can't answer any more questions. We have to be cleaned up and out of here. I have to have all the chairs put away by 10:30, so and be out of here completely. So I've asked Brother Bishop Sumption to give us our closing prayer. Please remember the donation box in the back, and thank you for coming.